This is Digital Story Podcast number 880, January 31st, 2023. Today's theme is Top Gear for Outdoor Photography. I'm Derek Story. When we explore the great outdoors with gear in hand, we require ruggedness, dependability, and usually an extra bit of reach. So among all the different options available today, what are the items favored most by experienced outdoor photographers? In today's podcast, we review their recommendations. I hope you enjoy the show. So we have so much to talk about today. Oh my gosh. We're going to start out with this top gear for outdoor photography. This is a terrific list with some really good items on there. And then I'm going to talk about Mastodon for just a moment, which is a social network alternative, really, to Twitter. I'm also going to do a follow-up for my Mac Mini project using Luma Display, repurposing a 2017 iMac. That has taken many twists and turns since we last talked. So lots of good stuff, and even more than that, but those are the broad brushstrokes for today. Let's start out with this top gear for outdoor photography. So I found this terrific article on outdoorphotographer.com, and I have a link to it in the show notes. And it's titled, 10 Best Cameras and Lenses of the Year, OP Editor's Picks. And I was looking at this, you know, and I look at these types of articles all the time because I really like seeing what the different publications, what they favor, what they like, what's hot right now, what isn't getting mentioned, all that good stuff. And this list in particular, I thought was very thoughtful, and so much so that I wanted to talk about it today. And I have some commentary on it, as you may imagine, but I want to take you through what outdoor photographers, some of the items that they're recommending for outdoor photography. And believe it or not, the timing's quite good because before we know it, we're going to be venturing outdoors ourselves, and we need to have whatever we're going to use for 2023. We need to have that stuff purchased. We need to test it. We need to even figure out what we're going to use. And maybe the trips that you're going to take will influence the gear that you're looking for, you know, all that good stuff. So now is actually a wonderful time to be thinking about outdoor gear. And again, I just thought the timing and the content of this article was quite good. All right, so let's start talking about what they like. Now, at the top of the list for them in terms of camera, their OP camera of the year is the Fujifilm X-H2S. My gosh, this camera is on such a roll right now. We've talked about it before. I was pleased and not surprised so much to see it the top camera for Outdoor Photography Magazine in 2022. I was thinking, here is another notable achievement for this camera. And in an outdoor setting, I mean, you know, we're thinking about it for all these different uses. And they're talking about for outdoor photography. So what they say is that Fujifilm introduced two new flagships in its APS-C sensor X series mirrorless lineup this year, the X-H2 and the X-H2S. Well, they're talking about the S here. For landscape photographers, the X-H2 is potentially the most appealing with its 40.2 megapixel sensor and pixel shift multi-shot capability that can produce image files of 160 megapixels. Our pick for camera of the year, however, goes to the X-H2S because of its versatility for both landscape and wildlife photography. The X-H2S shares the same X Processor 5 as the X-H2, but a lower resolution sensor of 26.2 megapixels. The smaller image size is ample for most uses and allows the camera to capture moving subjects with exceptional speed. The X-H2S can shoot up to 40 frames per second with full autofocus and auto exposure tracking using its electronic shutter of up to 15 frames per second with its mechanical shutter, an advantage for wildlife photographers looking to record the perfect wing position of a bird in flight or a momentary interaction or behavior. At its maximum speed of 40 frames per second, the camera can capture bursts of up to 184 frames. Step down to 30 frames per second, still incredibly fast, and you can get bursts of more than 1,000 images, well beyond what you would likely need in the field. The camera's autofocus system can identify and track a variety of subjects, including birds and animals. See, I find this really interesting because a lot of times when we see publications talk about their favorite camera, they become just spec heavy. In other words, you know, whatever has the top specification seems to have the edge towards being the top camera. And I like the thinking here where they're really considering the camera for how it's going to be used, in their case, for wildlife and landscape photography. And, you know, they get into this here. I want to read you one more paragraph about this. They get into this in this paragraph. Again, I just think this is good reviewing. When selecting our camera of the year, we look beyond the camera itself to the system of lenses available for it. For wildlife photographers in particular, lens options are arguably more important than the camera itself. Among the reasons we chose the X-H2S for distinction was Fujifilm's introduction of the XF 150-600mm f5.6-8 alongside the camera. In combination with the APS-C format sensor of the X-H2S, the new lens provides a focal length range equivalent to 229 to 914 millimeters. Due to its compact size, Fujifilm's X system has enjoyed popularity with street and travel photographers, and its lens system has reflected that, emphasizing wide and moderate telephoto focal length primes and zooms. With this new lens, the capabilities of the X-H2S, Fujifilm has signaled its intent to be a favorite among wildlife and sports photographers, too. It's really interesting. That lens, the XF 150-600mm, is really what put this camera over the top, in addition to the other things that they talked about. Now, I will tell you that, you know, I've been impressed by this camera and, you know, have thought about it for all sorts of uses, but hadn't really considered it as a top choice for wildlife and landscape photography until I read this article here. And I thought it was really eye-opening. So, okay, that was their top pick. Now, they had two runner-ups. And the first runner-up is the Canon EOS R7. So, again, they talk about, you know, what Canon introduced this year. And then they go into, of the two, the EOS R7 may be of particular interest to wildlife photographers. While both cameras offer continuous shooting rates of up to 15 frames per second with their mechanical shutters, the R7 can capture up to 30 frames per second with its electronic shutter. That's on par with continuous shooting speeds of full-frame cameras. The APS-C sensor's smaller size means that lenses like the Canon RF 100-500mm will have extra telephoto reach to help get closer perspectives on distant wildlife. So, you know, they're talking about comparing the R7 and the R10 here. Both cameras use autofocus system with subject detection capabilities derived from the AF system in the current EOS R flagship model, the EOS R3. Both can also record 4K video, though the R10 is limited to 24p and 30p modes, while the R7 is capable of 60p as well. So their runner-up is, again, a crop sensor, EOS R7 mirrorless, a terrific camera. And again, a little bit of a surprise for me, and I'm just enjoying their thinking on this. All right, they have one other runner-up here, and this one isn't a surprise to me, although I'm delighted to see it here, and that's the OM System OM-1. So this was their third top camera for wildlife and landscape photography. Let's see what they say about the OM-1. The OM-1 is an advancement of the Olympus OMD EM-1 series cameras, similar to the EM-1 Mark III and the EM-1X in design, but with enhanced capabilities. The 20-megapixel MFT sensor is a new stacked BSI type and is paired with the latest TruePix 10 image processor that's 3 times faster than its predecessor. The combination enables an increase in maximum ISO to 102,400 and improved dynamic range compared to previous models. Sensor shift image stabilization is built in, providing up to 7 stops of correction with the camera alone and up to 8 stops with select lenses. Another highlight of the OM-1 made possible with the new processor is the evolution of the system's computational photography technologies, which make possible features like in-camera focus stacking, HDR, and high-res composites up to 80 megapixels. The AF system is also new, with 1,053 cross-type focus points and the ability to calculate focus and exposure fast enough for 50 frames per second continuous shooting with full AF-AE tracking. With the focus and exposure locked on the first frame, the camera's burst shooting increases to an incredibly fast 120 frames per second at the camera's full resolution. So, okay, that's a pretty high praise indeed. And I just want to do just a little side note on the OM-1. So those of you that listen regularly to this podcast, you know I'm a huge fan of the OM-1 camera. I think it's absolutely terrific. And I'm really glad to see it in this list, and I think it deserves to be here. Interestingly enough, about the same time that I was working on this podcast, I got a note from one of our Inner Circle members, Harold. And he was in Antarctica. This is what he wrote. Your email found me in Antarctica photographing penguins with my OM-1. I can tell you that the AI subject AF for birds finds penguins on land as well as swimming and diving along the shores. And with its weather sealing, I don't worry about the occasional splash in the zodiacs. I love this camera. And so Harold, one of our Inner Circle members, he's field testing this thing, or just finished field testing the OM-1 in Antarctica, going around on zodiacs, shooting wildlife and landscape. And I think that's a very nice testament to what's going on with this camera. So those are the 3 top cameras recommended by the editors of Outdoor Photography: the Fujifilm X-H2S, the Canon EOS R7, and the OM system OM-1. Now, I do want to take a minute and share some of the lenses that they talk about, because these are just, there are some crazy lenses in here. There's not many of them I can afford, but isn't it fun to know what, the outdoor photographers, the professional outdoor photographers are really liking? So let me tell you about a few of them. I'm not going to get into the descriptions. I just want to, tell you what they are. Outdoor Photographer Super Telephoto of the Year, okay? It's the Canon RF 800mm f5.6 LIS USM. They absolutely love this lens. Now, it's 7.4 pounds, all right? So, now we're getting into some serious big guns here. And I just looked up the price on this. $16,999, $17,000 for this lens of the year, the Canon RF 800mm f5.6L. That is a very fast lens for that kind of focal length, $17,000. Okay, some of these aren't quite that pricey. Now, the Super Telephoto runner-up is the Nikkor Z400mm f4.5 VRS. And this is also, boy, just a beautiful looking lens. and it is a relative bargain compared to the Canon, $3,246 for the Nikon Nikkor Z 400mm f4.5. All right. I mean, that's like pocket change, right? Isn't this fun? Aren't these things crazy? And then we have the Fujifilm Fujinon XF 150-600mm f5.6-8. Okay. And this is the lens that they talked about when they were praising their camera of the year. Alrighty. And this bad boy will only cost you, and I mean, actually, I think this is a pretty good bargain, $1,999 for the Fujifilm XF 150-600mm f5.6-8. Heck of a lens here. It's I'm looking at it on Amazon. It's Amazon's choice. You know, they absolutely love this lens. Outdoor photographer loves this lens. So $2,000 for that lens, plus the camera, not too bad, right? Not too bad. Not too bad at all in terms of pocketbook stuff. Okay, what else do we have here? Let's go to the wides. Here we go. So on the wide angle stuff, they like the wide angle zoom of the year is the Sigma 16-28mm f2.8 DGDN, and that is a nice lens. $820 right now for that lens in the Sony mount, and it is in other mounts as well. Okay, so that's pretty fun. And then keep going on the wides here. The runner-up is the Nikon Nikkor Z 17-28 f2.8. That's a good, man, all these are such nice looking lenses. I just go, and that's $1,196. Okay. And then the other runner up on the wide angle zoom is the Sony 24-70 G Master II. This one's probably going to be a bit pricier. Let's take a look at it right here. Not too bad at $2,298. So that's an overview of what they like at Outdoor Photographer. I think it's a pretty cool lineup because they cover both the wide and telephoto and the cameras. If you're thinking about, outdoor adventure for this year, especially coming up with spring being here before we know it, take a look at this article and take a look at some of the other things. I didn't go over everything that was in there, and see what you think. I think the recommendations are very well thought out and terrific. Okay, I have a follow-up here to our AI discussion that we had recently. This is an article that was on DP Review, and I have a link to it in the show notes. AI-powered watermark removal poses uncomfortable implications for content use. All right, let me read you a couple paragraphs of this. Artificial intelligence being used to create photorealistic artwork is already causing significant unrest within the photography industry. But a new tool, watermarkremover.io, is among the most concerning. Watermark.io, which is available for free, uses AI to remove watermarks from images, as implied by its name. While there are some benign reasons that you'd want to remove watermarks from an image, for example, if you own the rights to it but can't locate the version without the watermark, but it's easy to imagine much more nefarious scenarios in which someone wants to remove a watermark from a photo. I could probably think of a few. This is an article centered around bashing watermarkremover.io. It has every right to exist, and the developers aren't completely responsible for whether users download a tool to do something illegal. Removing watermarks to steal photos is illegal, by the way, at least in the U.S. However, it's worth considering how the tool fits into an increasingly murky AI landscape. You can already edit watermarks out of images with photo editing applications like Photoshop. In some cases, it's very easy to do so. Where AI comes in is making complex tasks like removing multicolored watermarks with different opacity values much easier. So then, you know, after I read this piece, I took a look at the comments. The comments are always kind of interesting to see where folks are landing on this issue. And a lot of folks, at least the sense that I got from reading, is a lot of folks saying, hey, look, this is inevitable. It's going to happen. I mean, we can already remove watermarks right now. You know, without this tool probably speeds it up, which means you could, if you're in the business of removing watermarks, you could remove more. The tool is free. So, you know, okay, there's all of that. I didn't have this overwhelming sense of panic. It felt more like a sense of resignation with this another use for AI technologies. Now, we all know when it comes to AI and photography, there are so many wonderful things. We talked about this before when I brought this up a couple weeks ago, that on the whole, AI is making our life easier as photographers, both at capture and in post. And then there are these tools that, you know, maybe wander into the gray area a bit, and we're not going to use them, or at least I doubt that, you know, folks in our community are going to use these things to go to Getty and remove watermarks and then use the photos. I mean, that just, to me, honestly, still seems so risky and weird to even think about it. But it's another example how AI is just speeding everything up, making everything easier, whether it's, you know, totally good and helpful or whether it lives in the gray area. This is a interesting revolution that we're in the middle of right now. I'll continue covering this story and the different facets of it because personally I find it interesting as well. I want to let you know that I've joined Mastodon. And if you don't know what Mastodon is, it is a social network, a relatively young one, with a relatively small footprint compared to Twitter, for example. I think Mastodon has like 2 million users compared to millions and millions of users on the other socials. But I know that some folks are going there. They're leaving Twitter or leaving Facebook or Instagram and going over here. I was asked to join by the folks over at Medium.com where I do some writing, and they set up an area there and wanted me to be part of it. I was happy to do so. I hadn't really, you know, explored anything after being banned from Twitter. just kind of cooled it on the whole social network thing. But I thought this would be a good way to learn about Mastodon. If you're interested in looking me up, I'm on there as Derek Story. And I have a link to my profile page on Mastodon in the show notes. It's just Derek Story, all one word. And if you're on there and, you know, you want to follow each other, then just look me up and then I'll follow you back. And, you know, we'll take a look at this. I'll give some reports up the road to see if I feel like this thing has much traction or not over time. But for the moment, I will tell you that the interface is nice and it really has a good vibe, and we'll see how many users it ends up attracting. Okay, I want to do a follow-up to our lead story from last week, which was really kind of two sides. The first side was Luma Display, a dongle and software that allows you to repurpose all sorts of things as a display, mainly as a secondary display, but can be a primary display also. And especially this was true on the Mac side since Apple eliminated target mode. Luma Display, I just want to be clear, and I mentioned this last week, but some folks acted like I hadn't said that, you know, it also works with Windows, right? So this is both a Mac and Windows thing. Now, what I talked about last week's show was going with just a regular Mac Mini M2 as a workstation, using it alongside my 2017 iMac, and then using Luma Display so I could use the screen from the iMac for the Mac Mini. As I continued researching after the podcast, and I wrote about this on our Substack newsletter, The Nimble Photographer, on Thursday, because a lot had changed from when I recorded the podcast on Monday to Thursday even, and a lot more has changed since Thursday when I did the newsletter. This is what we call a dynamic story. I decided to go with the M2 Pro on the Mac Mini, and there were a couple things that switched me over to that. One is it looks like that the regular M2 only has HTML 2.0, which limits the number of displays you can drive, whereas the M2 Pro appears to have HTML 2.1. So that was kind of a thing. And then SSD read-write speed seems to be faster with the M2 Pro. It feels like they put an extra chip or two there to increase that. And then it just came down to getting 4 Thunderbolt ports compared to 2, just as I started thinking about configurations and all that. And it was pretty easy to consider spending the extra $200 to go with the M2 Pro. Now that I have it here running on my desktop, I'm super glad that I did. In terms of Luma display, I've got this puppy running great with my iMac. I have to tell you, you know, I told you I was waxing on the 4K display for my iMac last week. It's just such a pretty display, and being powered now by the M2 Pro, it's just so much fun. The thing that I'm going to tell you about Luma display is forget about Wi-Fi connectivity. It's just too slow for what we do. Ethernet comes close, and I would say the Ethernet connectivity is fine if you're going to use Luma display as a second display. In other words, you've got your primary display, you want some more screen real estate, maybe to have your calendar and do notes and things like that. The Ethernet connection for Luma display works fine for that. I didn't like Ethernet for the primary display because I felt like the mouse performance just wasn't quite there. It was close, so close, but not quite there. And it's one of those things where close isn't close enough, right? It's got to be something that you're already used to, or it's just going to drive you nuts all the time. So I sprung for a Thunderbolt 4 connector that I'm using between the Mac Mini and the iMac. It looks like a USB-C cable, but it's not. It's a Thunderbolt cable. I mean, and what I mean by that, it does more than just regular USB-C. That changed everything. That changed everything. So once I started connecting using Luma Display and the Thunderbolt cable between the Mac Mini and the iMac, then I started seeing the performance that I wanted. I really liked it a lot. It was still like though at 90%, and I was going, gosh darn it, what would it take to get to 100%? And I just made some tweaks in the software setup, in the settings, and that's really what I've been doing for the last couple of days, just making some settings adjustments, experimenting a bit. So the way that I really got this over the hump to where I'm super satisfied and can use it for everyday use is I bought a little external display, spent $99 on it, and it's a QQH 15.6 full HD portable monitor. It looks like a little laptop screen is what it looks like, and then it connects via HDMI or USB-C. It's really super light, has a kickstand in the back, and it costs $99. And I'm going, okay, so I plugged that directly into the iMac, and that gave me a main display for configuring everything else. I was using an HDMI television, which was fine. I said that last week, but it was like way too big. It wasn't as sharp as I wanted and all that. And I wanted to use it for other things, and I didn't want something that big in my workroom. So I got this little thing for $99. It came with, by the way, all the cables I needed, and a little power supply or a little power connector. And it's really terrific. So I have that if I need to configure the Mac Mini. And then the key settings were setting up mirror displays instead of doing secondary display. In other words, basically in the Luma display settings, I said mirror both of my displays, the iMac and this new QQH display. And then I designated the iMac as the main display. And then I also made it full screen. They have like a full screen mode, so you don't see, it just looks like, you know, a regular display. When I did those three things, bang, it just clicked. And it's amazing. It performs exactly the way that I want it to. I've got no beefs at all. I only use the little 15.6 inch LCD when I need to do something technical, like I need to configure something, or I need to look at the Luma display software and make some changes, or, you know, little things like that. So, and I do have it as a second display now too. So it's pretty cool. I did a big photo job on the iMac Saturday, actually. I had to finish it up. And this was a huge job for one of my clients. Had a whole bunch of headshots and everything. So I edited it using Capture One Luma display on the iMac with the Mac Mini powering it. Did all my edits. The workflow was fine. It was great. It was beautiful. It was so much fun using the iMac display. Then I output all the images, and there were something like 85 deliverables for this job. I output them, and then I looked at them on my MacBook Pro, which is calibrated, and I trust the calibration on that to make sure what I was seeing on the iMac was a good deliverable. And they look great. They look great. So I got the iMac, you know, all dialed in. I've got all the settings dialed in, the whole deal. So I ended up buying the Mac Mini, the M2 Pro. I ended up spending almost about $250 for the QQH display, which is $99, Luma display, which is $120, and then one Thunderbolt cable. That all came to about $250. I'm still using my iMac as the main display, and I absolutely love it. I've got this cool little 15.6 inch display that I can not only use with the Mac Mini when I want, but I can put it in a laptop sleeve and use it as a second display for my MacBook Pro and anything else too. So it's kind of fun, and I was amazed at how good the quality is for $99. By the way, I'll have the link to it in the show notes. And I am just in tall cotton right now. I am really happy with this setup. So I just wanted to give you that update, and I'll post a story, of course, on Facebook, and I'll do a little follow-up on Substack probably too. It's done. And I'm smiling. All right, let's take care of a little virtual camera club news. Let's start out with the Nimble Photographer newsletter, because I just mentioned it. You know, it is so handy. Again, I keep saying the same thing over and over about this. But I finish up the research for the podcast on Monday, and I record the podcast on Monday. I do the newsletter on Thursday, and a lot of times on these stories that I'm working on, things change between when I finish, where I have to cut off my research actually on Monday, and then I keep going after I publish the podcast, and a lot of times I discover new things or new things come to light. Then I have the Thursday newsletter to talk about those changes. So if you listen to the podcast, you probably should get that free newsletter too, just because these stories live on, and there's usually more information. And the M2 is a perfect example of this, because on the podcast, they said, well, I'm probably going to go with just the M2. And then, you know, if you're thinking, well, if it's good enough for him, maybe that'll work for me. And then on Thursday, I'm going, no. I did some more research, and I'm going, no, I got to go with the M2 Pro, and that's what I ended up spending. So if you're interested in, you know, that kind of engagement, the Nimble Photographer newsletter is really good. It's free. There's a link to it in the show notes. You can just go to thenimblephotographer.com. There's a link at the top of it. And it just really helps, you know, flesh out these stories as they continue, as new things continue to come to light. A big thanks to our Inner Circle members. These are the folks that support our community month in and month out. One of the things that I thought was really interesting, when I was considering joining Mastodon and stuff, I was just curious at how our Inner Circle members felt about Mastodon. And, you know, of course, this is, you know, one of the things that we do together. And so I asked them about it, and only 14% said that they were active on it. 36% said they knew about it but hadn't pulled the trigger, and 18% said it just wasn't their thing. So that really gave me a good idea going into this that, okay, I'm experimenting with something here, but it is not big in our community. These are the kind of things that happen with the inner circle. In addition to sharing information and pictures and stuff with each other on an inner circle group or space on Derek Story Online, they're just a great source of knowledge, and they help fund this podcast so we don't have to have ridiculous commercials, which nobody wants to hear. A huge thanks to our Inner Circle members. And if you're interested, click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. And finally, a huge thanks to our friends at Red River Paper. These are the folks that support the printing community. They support this podcast, and they are some of the nicest and most knowledgeable people in the world of inkjet printing. I can't imagine just working with anyone else for my inkjet printing supplies and for just learning all the ins and outs of inkjet printing. They're just terrific. They have a tile on all the pages of Digital Story. You can click on it. It takes you to our landing page. You know, there's a little offer there usually. That's kind of nice. But then you can navigate and you can learn about all the different projects you can do. You can learn about what paper is best for certain subjects. You can learn about printers and inkjet printing in general. And of course, you can buy paper there. Longest running sponsor of the Digital Story, Red River Paper. A huge thanks to them for supporting this podcast. And if you're on Facebook, be sure to visit them at facebook.com/Red River Paper. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Lots of fun stuff. I'm working on some great stuff for next week. Until then, be creative. Start planning your 2023. Take lots of pictures. I'll see you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.